or cursorily today, reach out to me by email. I usually respond better to text, but it always seems a little weird to give a room of 70 people your phone number. So I will do that, but probably on the one-on-one side.
You've done it before.
Have I done it? Okay. Yeah, I guess I forget what I've done. Not a good sign. So the discussions I had with the senators all began with follow-ups from things that we were working on last semester. Yes?
Approve the agenda.
Oh, my gosh. Some things never change, Carla.
I know.
Yes, thank you very much. Second on the agenda? All in favor?
All right.
Any abstentions? And people who are not allowed to vote, don't bother answering. Any negatives? Thank you. And now,
I know, I need to approve the minutes.
You think after 3 years I would get this down, but apparently not. I'd like a motion to approve the minutes from the April 24th meeting, is it?
Yeah.
So moved.
Thank you. Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Any abstentions? Negatives? Thank you very much.
What else, Rick, am I forgetting?
Now the posthumous degree.
Oh, I really did go out on a limb. Something sad we have to deal with, actually. I apologize for that.
Let me have, thanks, an agenda.
So, Associate Chair Susan Halter, could you join us in civil engineering? She's going to present us with the request for a posthumous degree for Jesse Helton, who is going for BS in construction management.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming today, Susan, and pardon my flipping over.
No, that's okay. Thanks for inviting me to come. As you can gather, one of our undergraduate students, Jessica Holton, unexpectedly passed away this past winter. He was pursuing his Bachelor of Science degree in construction management. Jesse was a senior. He was maintaining a GPA in the high threes in our department. And his advisor looked at his file and determined he was just one course away from finishing his bachelor's degree. He would have graduated this past spring had he continued pursuing. So the department faculty all agreed unanimously that they would like to pursue awarding Jesse Helton his bachelor of science degree in construction management posthumously. That was supported by our department chair and by the dean of the School of Engineering. So I guess I'm here to present it to the Faculty Senate.
Are there any questions on this request? No? Okay, so I'll need a motion from the floor.
Make a motion that we grant the degree in BS in construction management.
Thank you, Carla. I need a second.
Come in.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Abstentions? Anyone in opposition? Great. Thank you so
much.
I really appreciate it. And tell the parents that we're doing this gratefully and okay. So good. I will slow down now. I was told, actually, one of the comments I did get when I asked senators what I could do a little better was, could you speak more slowly? And I actually told him today that I didn't think today was going to be the day, but I'm going to try. We get a second chance every minute, right? So here's my new minute. First, I would like to be a little more gracious than diving in and introduce my team to you. So I'm just going to go in the order that they're seated. This is Jeffrey Long from Anthropology. Vinny Coleman is our president-elect. He's from Africana Studies in English. Oh, my God. Brandy Fink is from, I'm going to get it, Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. Got it. And she is the behavioral scientist, so had I left that out, it would have been bad. Jason Wilby, I know you remember from, he's German,
foreign languages.
Nancy Lopez is from sociology. And Bob, Robert Orlando, you've got to tell me,
biochemistry and molecular biology.
Okay, he's on the other side of campus, great.
So thanks for filling that in. So this is your new operations team. Jason and I are the only holdovers from before, but I know you'll find them as stimulating as I do when we have talks as the year goes on. Ops, as Lee can attest, is always an interesting exchange of ideas.
That's one way to put it.
Yeah. Interesting is that word that we use in New York, right, to mean anything. All right, so the first thing I wanted to attack, and that's why I dove in, last year, as you recall, we combined the undergraduate and the graduate committees. We did it not in a haphazard manner, but we did it in an informal manner to see if it would work. Caught a little flack from the Committee on Governance for not doing it in a more
parliamentarian manner, perhaps, by doing it formally.
And the reason I told a lot of you this, so since 47 of you have already met with me, bear with me, we didn't want to make a change in the Constitution without seeing if it worked. We believe we're on the right track to getting this to work, and now we're working with Pamela Chief, the Associate Vice Provost, and the chairs of the committees, and the registrar, and everyone you could possibly name to be involved, to see if it works. this is combined with our need for internal efficiencies and with the fact that HED has some new requirements. So some of the forms are going to be processed differently, and we think this is the best way to do it. So we have not yet decided, with Kennedy's help, what's the best way to approach it this year, but I want to assure you, and we'll have reports on this, that we are working on it, and it's not a haphazard approach. So we feel we've taken good steps in that direction. Another thing that came up with only a few senators, and actually one of them had to take a sudden leave of absence, but not just on his behalf, but to represent the faculty that were concerned about this, I did ask former Provost/President Abdallah to give me the intel, and I use the term a little bit as a pun, on our CIA involvement. Sorry, the emails I kept saying, for your eyes only, you know, it was getting a little out of hand. So he said, as promised, he sent me something the other day, and I wanted to give you the background on it. And I know President Stokes will speak about it at some point, not sure if today's the day, but should we decide to go forward with this, we will have the discussion now. So this is interesting. We became an SSP, which is a signature school program of the CIA or with the CIA, under President Bob Frank and John Brennan, the director at that time of the CIA, in November 10th, 2016. And the rationale behind the CIA looking for these, without speculating on other rationales, was to make the intelligence community reflect the country. So culturally, linguistically, educationally, ethnically. They picked us, accordingly, because we have a rich academic program, and we have a diverse cultural, ethnic, and linguistic body, and also because we have good 4- and 6-year graduation rates. So I thought those were good reasons to be picked. And here's the goal. This is the goal I'm being told of, right, is that it's helping UNM students improve their competitive edge as they apply for careers in the intelligence community and other national security and foreign policy agencies across the U.S. And we had the highest percentage of recruits from our school compared to the other SSPs when it happened. Now, in case you don't know what I'm talking about, the discontent came. I received some emails from other faculty senate presidents saying, hey, do you know you're a signature school? I said, well, I do know, but I don't know what that means. So I've asked, eventually, President Stokes will address it. And again, I'm not putting her on the spot. Today may not be the day. Why are we one? Is it good for us? Many people have told me they feel it is good for our students because it gives them another job opportunity. And I think what we need is just the opportunity for folks to weigh in on that before another agreement is signed. That's what I've been hearing from people. Any comments? I do want to pause there. Does anyone have a comment about that? Yeah, Lee, please.
What were the results with the last agreement?
We got
respect to Johnson.
They hired 16% of applicants, or over 25 individuals, received conditional offers of employment. I don't know how far it went. This is, you know, the only page I have. So. The percentage is one of the highest among signature schools, and that percentage of applicants to this program or to get this opportunity in Tier 1 universities in the United States Central Region does not exceed 10%. So we're at 16%. So a lot of our kids got jobs that would not have without this program. So that's a good question. So I don't want to treat it perfunctorily today as the first Senate meeting, so I'm bringing it up. We'll see where we go from here with the next months. On a pleasant note, I wonder if you could put this up there, David Hansen's. So our chair of our Research Policy Committee and the Research and Creative Works Council, David Hansen, who I can't say enough good things about from biology, they were charged last year to come up with ways of creating more research and faculty and creative work awards for faculty. And they found a lot of holes in the process. Like, for instance, it's very hard on the website to even find a list of, hey, you could apply for this award. One. Two, they're not enough in the research and creative works arena. And three, here, there it is. The status are not as elevated as, say, the distinguished and the regents. And he's wondering if we might do that. He even suggested, I think it may be number six, a regents award, something like the magnitude of that, there we go, to develop named and early mid-career research grants. So I presented this both to the provost and the president, and they will consider it, and I'm not sure it will go from there, but this is a really positive effort from the Senate. And we are looking to empower our faculty, yes, thank you, to feel better about getting the recognition they deserve for the things they do. Okay, I also apologize for only giving myself 8 minutes. I thought I could do it, and it's not working out. Let's see. All right, here's another thing that came from my discussions with you all. A lot of faculty have come to me looking for support for faculty in regards to
difficult student situations. So there's, yes, and I see a lot of people nodding, and I was surprised about that, actually. I encountered such an experience only once in my time here, but I understand that. There have been incidences where faculty have felt threatened by students and have felt that the law is on the side of the students and a little misty on the side of the faculty. So we're not trying to pit us against them, but how can we create a learning environment where the student gets the education they deserve and the rest of the students and the faculty get the safety and efficiency that they deserve to have good learning? So since, sadly, Christopher Lyons brought it to me, he is now the chair of that committee, so beware when you bring me something that you will be asked to work. And the committee is, we just staffed it yesterday, so it has a gentleman who's here, William Garber, who I just met. It has Sean Berman from Anderson, Associate Dean of my college, Regina Carlo, and also Diane Marshall. And these are all folks who have dealt with this, and it'll be run behind the scenes. Rich and I, the provost and I, will be working on seeing what direction it goes. And more of you may be called on to participate in that. My new brilliant idea this year is that maybe some of you will get involved in the issues we're talking about. I think it's great that we have an ad hoc committee that Christopher is steering. We're not going near our other committees because they have so much work to do. So some of you may have special issues and we can talk about those. Another one that came up, and so Lindsay, I told you I might put you on the spot, and so I will now, cheating websites. Well, who knows about these? Oh, okay. Well, I didn't actually. I do know that when I had a lot of football players in the class I first taught here, they all wrote the same amazing paper on Wagner. And I was like, really? And they claimed to have listened to the entire ring when I'd only assigned like 10 minutes. I thought, well, something's going on here. I'm sure it's all better now, though, so I don't want to cast an aspersion against any group. But Lindsay, tell us what you know. Where'd you go?
Oh, well, they're sensibly kind of studied health websites, and a lot of them are paid, like, subscriptions, and so students can page and kind of unlock material, and you know, the idea is that other students will upload notes and things as study guides for another group of students in class, but turns out there's tests and fully completed labs and quizzes and all the stuff that, you know, you can pay and get access to this material. And so, you know, a faculty member in my department brought this up to me, and she's also brought it up with Dan Marshall and some other folks in the administrative, but she suggested we take it to the faculty senate and see if there's some way that we could do something, add it to some honor code, or I don't know.
So again, not solving any of the world's issues today, but bringing out what they are. And one of our senators who I talked to earlier today, I said, you know, you're on my mind because you were very astute in saying to me, hey, you're doing a lot of things. What are our priorities? And I told him just now, I feel like he's my dad saying that, but he's right. So thank you for that. And I took it seriously. Ops will, of course, be guiding that decision, but with your help. So that is one that seems it rises to the level of perhaps our curricular committee, but they're overburdened as it is. Maybe it's another ad hoc committee of our group that can just target. My goal is we look into things as quickly as we can if it's not an in-depth issue that needs years to look at. And we try and come up with solutions or at least have a conversation. That's my goal. Quickly, because I want to honor some of the conversations I had, I remember Matthias brought up, you know, we needed ideas to help with recruiting. So that was an interesting group that I met with. I can't remember who it was. Was it Alan who said Texas students only 5%? Was it you? So one of in our group, John Matthews, somebody, said only 5% of Texas students go to Texas schools. So I know this is a little out of our purview, but Terry, enrollment, I don't know, you know about that. What can we do as faculty? And I have proposed faculty-led trips abroad to help with that. And Matthias was involved with LAII when that was happening. So that's another area of interest. I'm not sure it's our bailiwick, but that's one that has come to me, and I also believe firmly we need to reach out in some way. And at the same time, I remember, I think it was John, you were saying that some of our international students don't feel particularly welcome here. So that was news to me because I have a one-on-one relationship with my students. So I think if they like me, they feel welcome. If they don't, that's another story. But perhaps other ones are lost in the fray. So that's a larger issue, I guess, to talk about. And just two more things. Governmental relations. Remember last year we held the first competition where faculty were able to come up with, so exciting really, their own desire for capital funds. So because I've been saying to presidents for years, you guys pick this, why don't we pick it? And so it was a competition. I know, you know, you guys participated from engineering. And the winner
was a college of pharmacy, and we got them $88,000 for restoring their call center and updating it like that. So we're going to have another competition this year, and that'll be run by my governmental relations committee. And that, in conjunction with, remember our other project, which was tying the research of our faculty to the legislative needs of our senators. Now, I tend to be a person who wants everything her way. No surprise to anyone who knows me. But I realize we have to be a little open-minded, because my thought was, and senators have come to me, make sure that's two ways. Make sure, okay, you need this information, but let me tell you, I know you need this information. I think we're going to have to step it back a little on that one. I think I met with Connie Beimer yesterday and Matt Munoz from the Relations Office, Governmental Relations Office, and they were saying that energy, education, tax reform, healthcare, economics, and water resources, these are the areas they need our help in. And I think if we try and push our own agendas too soon, let's prove ourselves. Let's find the people with expertise in those areas, prove ourselves. And I don't know, I won't say anything about money, but the Provost's Office and I are working on hopefully coming up with some small amount of money to compensate the faculty whose research is used in this. Does that sound reasonable to everyone, to not say, hey, I'm doing something on the music of Bach and you should really have a bill about that? But we say, I see you're doing it. Although I won't give up on it. I'll do, yeah. Well, support, but apparently there are only two bills about cultural stuff and 50 bills on water resources on the other thing. Tax reform, there are 14. So does that sound reasonable? Anyone have a thought on that? I know I'm throwing a lot at you, as usual, but we're going to prioritize them before our next meeting. Okay, and the last thing is a happy thing. President Stokes will have been in office 200 days on September 17th. So she will give a State of the University address on that day at noon. So mark that in your calendars. Will it be webcast?
No.
Okay, so I would think so. We can't afford it. We've had to take the webcasting off hours. We saved $2,000.
For the whole year?
For the whole year. Yeah. That's a lot of money for us. That actually will compensate one of our chairs that we need to do for the curriculum.
I sure
yours should be, of course. I mean, I guess technically ours should be too. But
so what is your webcasting?
The webcasting.
For what?
To give a $2,000 sack to the curricula chair, because the work is like 30 hours a month, like way above.
No, I meant what was being
watched. This meeting.
Oh, this Senate.
This meeting.
Our Senate meetings, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Or they were just sound, right?
Just
sound.
Audio.
Sorry.
I'm audio.
Computer illiterate, so I don't know. I put them all under the same umbrella. But in addition to that, I've had the privilege of working with her office to create some other events. Faculty Focus, you'll remember from 2.5 years ago. We're doing another one with Kathy Powers from Political Science, Mahmoud Taha from Civil and Biomedical Engineering, Biomechanical Engineering, and Jason Williams from, he's an EMT that hangs off cliffs. You always have to have someone that makes the Regents go, ooh, that's cool. So he'll be the, oh, that's cool. And then I'll provide some form of music for the event as well. That is on September 20th, and that is at 6 o'clock in the Memorial Chapel, or the Alumni Chapel, I think it's called, and come at 5:30 for cider and donuts. Sorry, I've got to plug it. 6 o'clock, the event, and then a reception at 7 o'clock. We're hoping to invite legislators, of course, faculty, staff, community members, and donors. So this could be a very nice informal way of hearing what your colleagues do and connecting with people that impact your life in some way. And then the other event we helped plan was a walking tour on Friday, the 21st, that goes from the chapel and ends in Popejoy, led by historian Charlie Steen, who's head of our academic council, and Arif Khan, who is the head of the museum that resides in my college. And they're going to give little tidbits, either architecturally or historical knowledge of the campus. I think it's a great idea to get people involved. All right, I am concluding as fast as I can. Any questions right now on that? Thoughts, questions? And there are, just so you know, President Stokes, there are a million more things faculty asked about, and I will update you on those someday. But I really took a lot of notes because I wanted them to be heard. Okay, so now, are we going to the president?
Provost
first. I can't find my agenda, so
here. You're lending me yours now.
Provost Richard Wood, please come join us.
And
would you like to sit or
I'll
stand?
Sit. I think I'll sit.
Okay, come sit with us then.
You
know what? Actually, no, it would be better if we switched out. Come here. Thank you, Bryn.
10 minutes, is that
what
we have?
Oh, do what you need to. I mean, clearly I have no sense of time.
Hi, all. My name is Richard Wood. Some of you I know very well. Some of you I know a little bit, and some of you I've not met before. So I thought I'd give you just a quick bit of background. As you know, I've just been appointed as interim provost for this year. And I thought, I'm not going to tell you a whole life story, but a bit of background so you know who you're dealing with, mm-hmm. I thought might be useful. And then I'm just going to tell you some of the key initiatives going on out of academic affairs right now and leave a little time for some questions about that might be most valuable. So just a quick sketch. I grew up in northern New Mexico, left at 18 for college in California, ended up in California or in Latin America for about 5 years, Mexico and Central America mostly. Then went back to graduate school in Berkeley. And after all that, talked my way back into a job into beloved New Mexico. My parents are getting elderly. I wanted to come back. I'm a professor of sociology now, and I'm in the current role. I think the most important piece here is I'm in this role not on the traditional trajectory as chair and dean and up into the provost office. I've served as chair in my department in sociology. I directed the religious studies program for a few years. But then I made the mistake of becoming an associate professor of agreeing to co-chair the Committee on Governance. And at a time of crisis at the university, we'd been through 25 years of burgeoning student enrollments with no new investment in faculty hiring. And it was really a crisis in the academic mission and the research in the university. And a group of maybe 20 of us from the faculty organized an insurrection, frankly. There had been some incredible ugliness directed towards, in particular, female faculty from the regions of that time. And there was just lack of investment in the academic mission. And a group of about 20 of us used the tools of faculty voice in the university to try to turn that around. And that generated a vote of no confidence in the president of the regents at the time, and in the president at that time, not our current president. Thank God. But I'm very unapologetic about that. I truly believe that New Mexico was being ill-served by the way the university was being run, and the faculty would have been irresponsible not to step into that. It resulted in the governor requesting that the president of the region step down, and the president at the time was adept enough to sort of shift the way he was governing and inviting a whole bunch more faculty voice. Hasn't made everything perfect, as you know better than I do, but it was an important moment in terms of claiming a voice on the academic mission. But I was still an associate professor. I did that for a while. I ended up sitting in this chair for a year as president of the faculty. Served as a strategic advisor in the provost office for a year or two. And then my colleague said, Vince, you're still an associate professor, right? So then I kind of retreated out of the university leadership and went back and finished a book I'd been working on, articles and things, and was promoted. I've served as an interim senior vice provost for the last year after the vice provost and two associate provosts all departed within a couple months of each other, and was just appointed recently as the interim provost while we do a national search. The president is going to do a national search this coming year. So that's me. What I write about is religion and politics in the contemporary world, mostly in this country, and not what you think of when I say religion and politics, but in poor neighborhoods, African-American, Latino, working-class white, other settings, when people work through congregations and synagogues and mosques to try to get government services for poor communities. What does that look like? What's the role of religion in that? I do a little bit of work in Central America still around kind of liberationist forms of Christianity. What we're working on now in academic affairs is essentially an agenda that we developed. All of us were interim last year, right? Craig White was provost. I was senior vice. Pamela Cheek and Alex Lumen were associate. We were all interim last year. We did a bunch of work. There's a whole bunch of keeping trains running on time, but we also worked to lay the groundwork for a number of things that now we're really moving to implement as I've now been appointed as senior vice longer term. Pamela and Alex have both been appointed to their positions longer term. So I'm still interim as provost, but the other positions are more stable. So I just wanted to sketch for you what those kind of project things are beyond the usual stuff we do. I'd flag one as really part of what President Stokes has spoken often about as a university for New Mexico, not just a university of New Mexico. One way that we framed that over the last year, that this particular language came out of the Task Force on Equity and Inclusion that I chaired, this language, framing the university's mission around excellence and equity. And the thinking behind that was, UNM has in good faith, I think, been committed to academic excellence for a long time and committed to racial and gender equity for a long time. But it's kind of worked on those things in separate tracks. And they've never really added up to more than the sum of the parts, was our view on this committee. So we articulated this search, but I also articulate how I think about the university's mission in this particular state as absolutely fully committed to research and teaching excellence and deeply committed to gender and racial and equity in American life across a whole bunch of different kinds of categories. And that UNM, in particular because of where we are, our history, the land we occupy, UNM's best play for real national prominence is to wed those things and commit to them and build the culture that can really sustain both those things. And importantly, because resources matter, if we do that right, we become the leading edge of universities that are really meeting the demand in American society for the next generation of leaders, right? Not just replacing you and I as faculty, but institutional leaders in politics and the private sector and nonprofits and communities all over the country. And that the federal funders and the big national foundations are absolutely ready to fund universities that really get that right. Not just talk about it, but build a culture, talk about it, and deliver that pipeline to a different kind of a future that this country so desperately needs. So that's front and center for me. A lot of work, President Stokes is leading a bunch of work on faculty and staff compensation. As you've seen in the paper, there's a lot of new resources in the state this year. We think we have a claim to a bunch of that to meet the compensation challenges. Out of the Senior Vice Provost's office, I was leading this until the new situation, but I'll be handing this off to a vice provost to be appointed soon. We'll launch a search for that this week. Another round of studying of the equity in faculty compensation, particularly gender and racial equity in faculty compensation. I believe we can do that now in a mode that makes sure that we're rewarding faculty in situations of inequity who are also contributing powerfully to the academic mission. I was a chair when we did one of the last rounds of this. Felt like we rewarded a lot of really good faculty, but also rewarded some faculty who hadn't published or taught effectively. And I just think that's a mistake in that commitment of excellence and equity. And so I think we can create a process that will act on equity issues and at the same time do that only in cases where people are really contributing to research. Which is most cases, but a kind of check off if there's individuals who aren't. We're not giving money to folks who haven't published in 10 years and aren't teaching successfully. Still moving forward on the redesigning the university piece, but important to say, those task forces that met last year and come forward with a series of proposals, that's just been synthesized into an overall report that we'll share with you all. It's ready to go public. But it's the start of a conversation, in particular with faculty leadership across the, in particular faculty senate and its committees, where it touches on tenure, or where it touches on governance with the other bodies, very much with the deans. It's the beginning of a conversation about where the university needs to go, not the end of the conversation. And we'll all flow into the process the president's leading around UNM beyond 2020, where the university is going more broadly. Want to double down on the research front in all kinds of ways. And then lastly, when I came in as vice provost, there was a mandate from the regents to come up with software that would better track faculty research productivity. We're required to report to the regents on productivity. The regents weren't very satisfied with our ability to report on research productivity. Now, there should be warning signals going off in your head. Well, you know, regents tracking research, what do they know about right? There's all those questions, right? And yet, they can mandate this. I came into a situation where I feel like we over-report in all kinds of ways. The reporting burden on faculty is huge, and to throw down another demand on that turf was just a terrible idea. So I and Gabriel Lopez, as Vice Provost for Research, have led a conversation this year looking at Can we instead produce a broad software capability that actually unburdens faculty of all those, you know, you report 10 different times in different ways at different levels of the university on different subjects that often overlap, and it's a royal pain in the neck. Could we instead produce a kind of integrated thing that allows faculty to report once in a much more efficient way, that's much more, less time consuming, and has a data governance structure that only allows access of your chair to the appropriate data, the dean to the appropriate data, centrally only where it's appropriate. That's the kind of goal to this project. And I'd like to propose that we enter into some conversation about what a data governance structure could look like. We think we can produce the software, either commercially or in-house, but what's the right data governance structure? So that's the stuff we're working on in academic affairs. I'm going to stop there, and we can either just stop there or if there's questions.
Questions for the provost? Some interesting projects. I know I'm looking forward to the re-engineering. Mm-hmm. How close are we to reading that?
Which we got the beloved Chowki Abdullah, despite his engineering roots, to retitle.
Yes, redesigning the university. Which is smart.
He said, what? What's wrong with engineering?
Soon, though?
The report we can send you very, it's just being formatted. We're ready to share that.
Good. Okay. I know it's the beginning of school, but if you have any questions, it's a good time. Yes, Robin.
Yeah, I have a question. Is there a place where we can access reports from the university passport?
Yes. The University Council has a website with a bunch of reports available on it. Some of them are also available on the provost website. Is there a particular
place? Oh,
I'm sorry. Yes, no, it's posted online. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
It is, I can send it to you, but it's also posted on the provost website called the DEI Task Force Report.
Thank you, Provost. Thanks for speaking. Yes, Raj.
So, Rich, I have a question regarding enrollment. I'm curious what percentage of enrollment decline can you attribute to us kind of signing agreement with, let's say, CNM, or that in fact we will be expanding into other universities. The concern I have is there's a significant tuition differential between us and CNM. So anybody with kind of simple logic, it doesn't make sense for them to take courses at UNM if they can take the same course and you get a transcript from CNM.
There's an important premise there that the course at CNM is the same as the course at UNM, which we are going to increasingly argue we offer something that nobody else can offer as the flagship research university. A couple clarifications. The big question isn't that UNM signed an agreement. It's that the state legislature mandated that the core curriculum in New Mexico, taken at any institution in the state, is fully transferable, unexamined, unanalyzed, into any other institution in the state. We just had no choice in that matter. So you're right, students can take it more cheaply at CNM and just transfer those credits fully over here. That is surely one of the factors driving the fall in freshman enrollment. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Rod.
So again, a follow-up to that one is, do we have some kind of plan in place which allows us to differentiate? Because I think when I was serving in the operations committee, I saw that one and I expect the same sense. I did not see anything which kind of helps us, our professors who are teaching those courses, to differentiate. Mm-hmm. There has to be some way which says, like, we should be, if you are taking courses at UNM, it's at maybe a completely different league or something.
Yeah.
So that at least we people experience, because if there is none, I think the story of defining enrollment should continue for a long time.
Shall I tackle this, President? Do you want to tackle this? Shall I tackle it, and you can correct me? How should we do it?
You can start tackling it, and I'll just follow up. I'm sure there'll be no correction. You'll know more about some of this than I will.
The differentiation question is crucial, because we're mandated into the situation. There's a part of a plan already in place and other groundwork being laid now. Associate Provost Pamela Cheek has done terrific work on this. The way we're thinking about it is UNM has already stepped forward with our core curriculum is live, ready to go based on what we were doing already, and then spend this year really crafting it and pitching publicly the ways in what we can, the ways in which we can do things that other places can't do. Pull undergraduate research into the core curriculum in some new way. Pull commitments on equity and inclusion, some of Nancy Lopez's work on this front. Pull UNM's ability to address issues of equity and inclusion at a whole different level than many institutions in the state. Front and center into the core curriculum. And sort of up the game that we play on the core curriculum on the basis of who we are as the flagship university. And get that word out publicly. We think that's the way we can differentiate. But the, you know, we've been mandated to have the same course numbers at the 100 and 200 level. We've been mandated to transfer everything. We have certainly taken a hit because of those things. Now, there's some other things driving the course, the enrollment decrease this fall, we can talk about, but that's one of about four or five factors that we think are driving the enrollment decrease.
Can you create two tiers of the system, similar to like maybe in the city of Arkansas, where you create something maybe more automated, and students can take it at a cheaper price, or you can match the price of the CNN and other universities, so that way they get a multiple offer.
Perhaps.
Okay, Tracy, and then we're going to have to wrap this one up to get on to the president.
I would just like to submit that both Boston Branch campuses help keep the students within the UNM system at that more affordable rate. So rather than considering external institutions like CNM, remember us as part of the solution and give it to students.
And I think we are aware of the parts that the branches play. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Provost
Wood.
Appreciate it. Congratulations on your new position.
I'll come back sometime if that would be useful.
Oh, no, every month?
Okay.
We invite you all
the
time. Yeah. President Stokes, please join us. Is this okay?
Yes, hopefully I can see.
Well, Terry's blocking.
Terry is
blocking. I'm going to move back. I'll treat the seat.
Okay, very good. Well, I will tell you that, hello, everyone. And I feel like I probably should stand out, but it's also the outer room. It's not coordinated in a way that makes that very easy. But glad to be here today. Beginning of a new semester, library first fall semester. So it's kind of exciting to be part of a regular academic year, which, you know, starting on March 1st just didn't make that possible. it's been a crazy, very crazy few months in my role. You know, I spent the first year, I visited with the Faculty Senate, I think, a couple of times during spring. And certainly by the time the semester ended, things were really starting to percolate. I did spend, as soon as the installation and graduation back in the spring, I began what we've called my statewide tour. And the reason why I thought that was so important is that when I got here, came to New Mexico, everyone assured me that nothing I learned anyplace else would matter. Things were going to be different here. And, you know, there's a lot of truth to the history of this place and the history of this university and also the history of our state that would suggest that one of the most important things I could do is to get to know this state as well as I could. I also did a summer reading list, which I've been told I have till September 1st to finish the last book on my summer reading list. Some of you may have recommended books that I read this summer so that I could learn more about the culture of New Mexico. The first thing I did was go to our branch campuses. And, you know, our branch campuses play an important role for the University of New Mexico. They serve communities that we can't really reach oftentimes here on our main campus. And so the first thing I did was visit all the branch campuses and the surrounding communities. I then set out on a tour throughout state where I had opportunities to meet alumni. I met with community leaders. I met with individual legislators in many cases. I had the opportunity to learn about some parts of our state through faculty and students who led me on various parts of my tour. So I ended up going to all 33 counties. I did it on the cheap, as cheap as I could. I did eat some green chili cheeseburgers, and, you know, I did see a letter to the editor saying I made enough money to pay for my own, and I promise you I did pay for my own green chili cheeseburgers. But it was a fascinating tour to go through southeastern New Mexico and hear about the challenges in our state, to do southwestern New Mexico, and, you know, I had a faculty member who took me on a little a hike in the Gila Wilderness, which I would have never known that was there. A faculty member who took me through Carlsbad, another faculty member who took me on to the Santa Fe Opera to do a vaccines tour there, Chaco Canyon, and I mentioned Carlsbad. So I got to see some things in between all of the huge numbers of meetings and the large number of miles that we put on a university vehicle. You know, I keep waiting for the picture to show up. It says physical plant. We're on a road that says it's not for vehicular traffic. We're not really good for it as we're going to the Gila Wilderness, but I figured we're following this faculty member from biology. He's taking us in the right direction. But then people saw us. I just know they're going to have a picture. But it never showed up on Twitter. You know, I heard a lot of things, though, on this. Certainly from the branch campuses, I heard a lot of things about things that we need to look into for ways that we better coordinate our efforts with our branch campuses. I also visited with three tribal councils, and so I learned a lot about things we need to do with regard to our Native American, our Native communities. I didn't know just how much we were already doing in many communities related to our healthcare system. So I learned about a lot of initiatives that we have going on all across the state, but also the needs of communities. Some of this is a challenge in many states in the country, the urban-rural challenges. Urban communities losing population, afraid to send their children to UNM, in part because their children might never come back. They might not only stay in Albuquerque, but they may choose to leave New Mexico. And that's because of the issues of the economic growth in many of these communities. And I know I met faculty, for example, who are working with cities that are trying to build, kind of rebuild their downtowns and rebuild their economic support and infrastructure and build opportunities for their communities for jobs. Eventually this will be something like this will be on the website. It's got some pictures. It's got some of the statewide themes that we talked about. You know, I was told they really wanted to see more internship opportunities. But what I'm hoping that will come of this is we are going to, and I will be talking about it more on my 200-day address to the campus, I'm going to share a lot more about what some of these lessons learned are, and then we're going to put together working groups to tackle some of these issues so that, you know, as was mentioned a little earlier, we can really be seen as a university for New Mexico. It's an interesting thing to be... To think about as a president. You know, I worked my way up through faculty ranks, and I spent my time working with my students and doing my scholarship. But once I got into a leadership role, you know, it forces a broadening of thinking about what it is that, you know, my department was doing first when I was the head of psychology. And then when I became a dean, it was, well, what is it we're really needing to do as a college? What serves our institution? And then once I got to a provost and then a president's level, what you discover is that, and faculty say this a lot, people don't really understand what it is that we do. And there is truth to that. There is truth to the fact that people don't really understand what our roles are at universities. And there are huge expectations for the ways in which we will serve the many communities that care about the university. And as alumni or as just taxpayers believe they have a stake in the decisions we make every day. It's a balance. But what I know is that know, as we think through what our priorities need to be going forward, finding ways to support our faculty and to support our staff and to promote our students' abilities to be successful, you know, have to be there at the top of our agenda. So I listened to Rich say, you know, he's not going to let go of that research agenda. We are doing some things there, and I hope to, bring out the different working groups that will be involved with some of the things that we hope to get moving on as this fall semester really gets underway. So that's it on the statewide tour. I kind of mentioned research. Do you all know what RPSPs are? Research and Public Service Projects. You know, those get turned in. We've got a lot of those we're trying to get through our board. They benefit faculty and students in a lot of different places on campus, but a lot of them come through academic affairs. So those are just ways, one of the ways that we try to get funding from the legislature. This is going to be an interesting year in the legislature because there is a lot of money, and you know that we have the political, the possibility of political changeovers. But I'll end up spending a lot of time involved legislatively as we try to figure out top priorities for higher education in New Mexico, and especially what we want to do for UNM. I'll be working with other university presidents on what our priorities are, but I can't help but believe that a big one among those priorities will be faculty compensation. So that's part of why I've asked for a lot of information about faculty and staff compensation so that I can be fully informed about where the gaps are and what the needs are going to be, because this is a year to really ask for some significant help. Tomorrow is NSF Day. How many of you are aware of that? We've got a lot going on related to that tomorrow, and the Smith Plaza ribbon cutting. Obviously, I'm doing a couple of searches. I hope to announce a new university council person soon. And then I have the executive vice president for administration and finance, and then the provost positions, and then the vice president for equity and inclusion, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So those are searches that will be ongoing, and I'll be paying a lot of attention. I've named interim leaders in my office because I lost my chief of staff to her husband became a dean in Iowa, and I couldn't tell her. I got her to stay for a few extra months. But it has slowed things down a little bit, but I've got Terry in as my interim chief of staff, and so he's doing – that's a good way for us to spend a lot of time thinking about enrollment. And I heard earlier the issue of how faculty can be engaged. I know that some best practices do, in fact, involve faculty in the recruitment and retention of students. It's just a critical part of what we all end up needing to do, and it's a very competitive environment that we're working in. I've made campus security a continued priority, and so what I'm looking to do is to perhaps expand the scope and the charge for our campus security committee, because I'm wanting to get a lot more input from our campus community, about what are the best investments for us to make. Because among the issues affecting enrollment are issues of concern about what it means to be in Albuquerque and what it means to be on our campus where there are fears related to campus security. I heard this across the state. I was in meetings with alumni where they would say, you know, I went to UNM and I loved it, but my children aren't going there. Mm-hmm. And it's because of what they read in the paper. So these are things for it. Some of this is a perception issue, but some of it is a reality issue as well that our faculty and staff and students are dealing with every day. The good thing about me living on campus is I do get some sense of what it means to be on campus at all hours. Not all hours, because I'm not walking around at 2 or 3 in the morning. I don't. But I do come home from events to my house from campus. And so, you know, I think it helps have a different perspective of what it is our faculty and our lecturers who are teaching late or leaving labs late or all the things that can happen on a 24-hour-a-day campus. So that's something I'm going to look for, you know, really your feedback about. I'm looking at my list, and and, you know, what is there an elephant in the room here in terms of what you want to talk about? I have no idea. But, you know.
Does anyone have a question for the president?
Well, I was just going to go ahead and say, obviously, you know, the unexpected thing to maybe expected or unexpected to deal with coming in this job was the issue in athletics. You know, I walked in and I told everyone I kind of wished this had gone away before I got here, and I was told it would, that this would all be taken care of. I think our athletic director was had a similar hope, and, you know, I went into a budget development meeting in March where, you know, I understood that our students were very concerned that our board would just decide to up their fees to take care of a challenge with the athletics budget. And our students didn't want that. In fact, I watched the moving around of fees to actually reduce how much went to athletics. Our faculty, of course, having dealt with cuts on the academic side and years of no raises, also were very concerned that we would forgive debt in athletics, that we would fill this deficit when there were other serious issues across the campus. So those were the things I heard. We were also put on enhanced fiscal watch, which I was told was a serious issue. And in fact, the letter I received from Barbara Dameron said that we risk having our budget not approved, which David Harris assured me meant that they wouldn't give us any money at all. If we didn't have an approved budget, we wouldn't have money flowing. Or they'd hold back 10% of our budget, which is a substantial amount. So that was the context in which I was operating in March. You might remember the board decided not to approve the athletics budget, that they approved the rest of it, but they said you have to come back with a plan to eliminate the deficit and the recurring deficit and pay back the remaining, the accumulated deficit. And the truth is, I put together a task force, and that task force couldn't find a way to eliminate that deficit without, we did a lot of shared services. You know that shared services means kind of a shift of resources, who's really paying for something. But it involved a $1.9 million cut to sports. And so that was public in April. And we began hearing from people immediately. Then in May, we received we had a draft, but we received the final version of our Title IX report. I am a supporter of Title IX. I believe in the value of Title IX. And I think it's a positive that we would, as an institution, really pay attention to Title IX. And Title IX is a lot of different things, but part of it does involve athletics. So that report was made public. I was told that was the first time a report like that had ever really been shared with an entire community. And then we were forced into, I will tell you what I believed is that our student athletes and our coaches should be given warning, a year's warning. And there were people who said we shouldn't go that direction, that we should cut immediately. In fact, I was asked to balance that budget for FY19, starting July 1st of this year. And I didn't think that was a fair thing. I heard what happened to the ski team before. It just struck me as not the right way to go. And so we set out to put together a plan for trying to balance the budget by FY20. There were lots of conversations, but I will tell you that, you know, there were some ways in which we needed to engage our campus community and the community that, you know, if I could go back, I would do this a little differently. But we were under such tremendous time pressure because we needed a plan by July 1st. I got the extension to July 19th. You know, it became what it was, and you know, you have a sense for what it has been on our campus. You probably know what our priorities, how we ended up thinking about things, which has led to a lot of individual conversations. We started off with a financial issue. We had a Title IX issue. And then those and the desire to stay in the Mountain West Conference turned out to be primary drivers of what happened. I've had a lot of people say, why do you want to stay in the Mountain West Conference? And did you look at alternative conferences? And I would say that there has been a look at alternative conferences. There has been a look at what it means to not be a Division I football school. And the cost of athletics is about the same. Except that when you're a Division I football school, you have an opportunity to actually raise more revenue if you can, in fact, make get the right investments. So this is too much for today's conversation, but I welcome the conversations that we can have about what this looks like going forward. But, you know, we ended up with a situation where we had been Title IX compliant by adding a new sport. So we added beach volleyball. Three years ago or so, where I think they're entering their fourth season. If you want to remain Title IX compliant, you have to hire a real coach, hire a coach full-time, have facilities, have operating costs, and you need to add another women's sport, at least one more women's sport. That's one way to be compliant. There's another way that's pretty complicated. It probably would involve switching. It involves meeting the demand for sports, and that would be defined through a survey process. It would also be defined by our current club sport. So if we have a club sport, we might be under that prong expected to add the women's sports that are club sports as athletics department supported sports. The other way is proportionality, which has been considered the gold standard for how you meet Title IX requirements. And this has created an issue across the country, because what you know has happened probably across the country is that the shift in male versus female populations at the undergraduate level has become increasingly female-dominated. So that has sort of changed the proportionality issue for sports and why across the country you're seeing, for financial reasons but also for Title IX reasons, why universities are having to make some really tough calls. But in the end, it boiled down to whether this institution would cut baseball or they would cut soccer. And I can tell you that none of those choices were good ones. We have 22 sports. It's more than a university our size could really reasonably be expected to manage and be successful. And I'm sure there's a part of the story that I've left out. But I thought I'd just kind of share a little bit with you of where we landed, how we landed where we did. We're moving forward. We're restructuring athletics and their administration. We're really looking at the Lobo Club, which is where their revenues can get increased because they're doing good dog fundraising, but they need a restructure to do that. We still have a plan where athletics is expected to pay back their deficit, but we didn't get to $1.9 million. Even with the pain that you heard about in our community for cutting the sports we did, we still have some more things to do because we didn't get to $1.9 million. And some people would say, well, if you couldn't fix the problem, why did you do any of it? Well, we have to do this. And we have more that we need to do. Frankly, I don't think we have the stomach for more at this point. There are opportunities to really build back. And so I hope to work with our athletics council and with others on, you know, what we'll be doing going forward. I know there are a lot of people who wanted us to cut football. And a lot of the tension that I've been hearing about is, you know, why did you cut soccer and keep football? And the thing about football is it's a lot of student athletes. I mean, it really is a lot of student athletes. And our Mountain West Conference bylaws, as are many of the bylaws of anything, well, Power Five conferences as well, required that we keep football, men's and women's basketball, and women's volleyball. And so that really kind of kept some sports really off the table as places where we would go to make cuts. And it's our men's basketball team is actually the producer of revenue for the sports for our athletics department in terms of actually producing more revenue than they cost in terms of support. This may be more than you want to know, so maybe I'll just shut up now.
Well, no, I actually appreciate you bringing it up because almost every senator asked me about that, and I did voice, I wrote a letter to the regents and the president saying, why is the Holy Grail of the Mountain West Conference so important? So I'm glad she's addressing it. I still think that's a conversation to have in the future, but I think you're right, how much can you take in 1 year? So I appreciate you having the guts to bring it up today. It's a big subject.
Well, I mean, I'm bringing it up everywhere. And I'll tell you one thing. Yeah. Once you make a really tough decision,
you've got to talk about it.
And you better be ready to say why you did it and what was really driving it. Even if people disagree. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to related to skiing and soccer in particular. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a really tough conversation. Lots of things that went into the decisions that were made. So, and I've had people say, well, why aren't the faculty talking about this? I said, well, for one thing, we really weren't able to engage the faculty in the whole conversation to begin with, so that would be a reason why faculty would. And then I know there's talk, but, you know, why weren't faculty standing up at the board meeting? I had a board member say, why weren't the faculty at the board meeting standing up supporting this? It's like, well, you know, can I tell you how complicated this is for faculty?
And what we did say, and I wrote to the regent, I said, this acknowledges the $23 to $24 million that academics have taken in cuts in the last 4 to 5 years. And I said that because I could just see them turning their laser now let's start sculpting out, you know, the academic mission. So some of us did, but it was not during a faculty senate session. You know, they did this during the summer. And
it all was driven in the summer, which is kind of the worst time. It was terrible for our athletic director, who met with students early, but then, you know, everything was really happening during summer when most of the student-athletes weren't here. And so they were getting communicated with in not the most ideal ways. You know, when you want to talk to people about tough things, you want to be looking at them when you talk about it. But anyway.
You know, my only fear with our program right now is I had actually tried to squeeze in Jared Dominguez's presentation while you were here. Is there any way we can ask you to stay? Finney's is just a couple of minutes long. Is there any way? Is there questions about the branches that he might feel best having, you know, your support as well?
Absolutely.
Could you?
I'm actually trying to look. Let me look at my calendar.
Okay, you do that,
stay.
And we'll do some business. Finney, let's turn it over to you now. Thank you, though, President Stokes.
Okay.
No,
the colleagues, we've been working on the committee selections for this fall. It's an ongoing process. It'll be a while before we have all of the committees fully staffed. What we've given, or what we're putting up now, is kind of a list of faculty who've been asked. Those numbers will be in yellow. Green are continuing faculty, and then blue are people who've been asked and have accepted an appointment or would like to serve on the committees that we have up. Give him a chance to scroll through some of the others here. There are some of these that aren't populated right now, but we have reasons for them not to be populated just yet, ranging from getting feedback from sitting chairs to...
And also the committees that were meeting quickly.
Yes.
We tried to attend to their needs.
So we tried to prioritize those. So these are the lists that we have today. We'd like to ask for the Senate to grant consent for these appointments to go on that are in the blue, and also for folks who are in the green to approve them to continue on committees. And of course, the yellows will turn to blues as we get them, and then the next faculty senate meeting will ask for your approval of those as well. So, I ask my colleagues for a motion.
The motion comes from Ops. Mm-hmm. We decided that we had some argument over it, so we just need a second.
Second.
Thank you. The all second.
All in favor.
All in favor.
All in favor.
Aye.
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 Opposed.
Opposed.
Abstain.
No abstentions.
Okay.
The second is for our summer 2018 degree candidates. We'll give Rick a moment to put that up.
It's on a list because it's not supposed to.
Because it's not supposed to be. Okay.
And so here are the privacy flag people. These people cannot be published. This list cannot leave the room. If anyone wants to look at them, they're free to look at them, but this one must stay.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. So this comes as a motion from Ops as well.
Do you have a motion to...
A second?
Second.
To approve? Thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No abstentions.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Fanny. So, Jerry, I think you've been abandoned by the president. I'm sorry. I tried so hard. Yeah. No, I knew she had something, but please come and join us. And I know we have Taos, we have two Gallup folks here. We don't have Valencia today, do we?
Yeah,
Valencia, sure.
To get it out of the way.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm being asked to do things properly. So normally in the handbook, as you can see by flipping over your agenda, the voting members of OPS, and there are five technically, there are seven voting members of OPS, but it allows for the president, the past president, to be non-voting. You know, if you've been a senator X amount of times and you stay on as past president. Among the five voting members of OPS, at least four colleges must be represented. So this is the first time in Rick's history we have three colleges represented. We have the College of Fine Arts, we have ANS, and we have the Health Sciences Centers. So we are asking for an exception to this Faculty Senate bylaw. The only people that ran for these positions were from those colleges. So in order to keep this operations committee intact and not violate our bylaws, we need to ask you all to approve that we are only representing three colleges up here. And this is a motion from us. So I need a second. If you happy to discuss it with you, this is all we know, though. So
first, a second, and then discussion.
Oh, thank you. So I need a... So move. Thank you, and a second. Like you were doing. I need a second first.
Yes.
You got it. Oh, thank you, Terry. Been here.
Discussion.
Any discussion on this? And this is why Rick's here. Yes, Lindsay.
Is there a precedent for this in 74?
So I'm turning to him. This is
not in the last 15 years that I remember. It could have before then, but this is the first time currently since about 2000, I think.
And it is meant, of course, so that we don't have all musicians up here. That would be kind of scary. But we don't want all doctors up here either, right? Physicians. So I will say that some people straddle both sides here of the main campus divide. I feel that Brandy does and Rob as well. And I feel that we're all from different areas. So we're not all from ANS in sociology or something, right? Only one of us is. So I would make the case for it. Yes, Alan.
The duration of these sessions?
The year.
How
this
long
year.
Is the duration being?
It's for this year. For this
June,
operations.
June 30, 2019.
Whatever this session is called. Yes. So that's it. Any other thoughts before we take a vote? Yes, Lee?
The fact that we really have the power to do this, but we're in a bind, so we've got to do something. So,
well, I don't know. Look, I'm following my guides here.
The bylaws, you all voted on your bylaws, so you are the body that would vote.
That's very nice.
Not the whole faculty.
No, because the
faculty senate bylaws that are owned by the faculty.
Oh, that's good. Sever, sounds good to you?
Okay.
Great. So I'd like to call the vote now. All in favor of retaining this group as it sits today, please say aye.
Aye.
Any abstentions? Any opposed? You're an abstention, Arlie? Okay, great. One abstention. Thank you, everyone, very much. Okay, Jerry, sorry. We're official now. This is Jerry Dominguez, who is what the director of all our branch campuses. What's your title now?
Serve as the branch liaison.
Okay, wonderful. And he knows our school inside out.
So, thank you, Madam President. So, let me just start by saying that the initiative for this came as part of our president's statewide tour. She visited, as she said, all of our branch campuses. And while she was there, she heard that the branches and representing those communities really felt like they needed additional access to bachelor and graduate programs. As you know, we have a very robust online program and manage online programs. I believe, Terry, we have at least 10 or 12 complete online programs, more coming, more effort being put into them. But for a lot of our communities, that isn't the choice of how they want to receive access to a bachelor's degree. So we went to work, working with Provost Abdallah, now working with Provost Richwood. Our president wants to see how we can become, quote, the University of Florida, New Mexico. One way to do this is to find ways to provide 2+2 degree programs at our branches. And, you know, they finish their 2 years. They either stop out because they can't relocate, or they transfer to UNM or other institutions and complete their baccalaureate program. What we're attempting to do is put forward a right of first refusal. if our branches, through their work on the campus or from the community, a request comes in that they would like to have a baccalaureate program or a master's program, they will put forward that request to the provost office. The provost will evaluate and determine how we can best move forward, working with the college that might be delivering that particular degree program, and respond to the branch saying, hey, we can do this, we want to do this, and then we'll go forward. Or basically saying to the branch, we cannot provide that degree program, and you are free to enter into an agreement with another institution that might be able to provide that degree program. So that's the nut and bolts. There's a lot of detail that still needs to be worked out. The general guidelines, the financial model, and how we will do it. A college may choose to work with their faculty, work with their department to say, can we do this? And we have a faculty member that may be able and willing to drive or find a way to deliver that program to Dallas.
And that's if the campus can't provide it themselves, of course, right?
Well, what Tyler was saying is that there may be opportunities where we have faculty at our branches that are credentialed and meet the requirements for teaching an upper division course. They do have wonderful faculty there. They have doctorates. They're very good in their discipline. So that may be one option. I'm also looking, as I said, on the BLT and looked at the new fellows program, there may be opportunity for doctoral students who will say, hey, I'd like that experience. The model will have to pay for itself. The tuition that it generates will be used as the revenue to compensate for instruction and other operational expenses. We'll probably spend the rest of this semester getting ready to launch this. Let me give you a couple of examples as I talk to our CEO at our branches. So Gallup, the Gallup Attending Public Schools, they have about 750 teachers. Not all of them have master's degrees. They want that to be advanced in the tier, but also to improve the quality of their expertise. The Gallup Attending Public Schools are willing to pay for their teachers to work towards a master's degree in education. We have to figure out how we can deliver that. What will work for everyone involved, our campus, our faculty, and our students. Staying with Gallup, they have about 36 individuals that are completing an AA degree in early childhood. In order for them to get the kind of job that they want, they're going to need that bachelor's degree. So we will be working with our College of Education to see if we can provide the remaining 2 years. Taos has early childhood and multicultural education that they would like. They have people that are competing. They want to be able to finish and get their bachelor's and maybe eventually move on to a master's degree. Los Alamos, our other branch, they have a need for business courses, and they're already working with the Henderson School of Business. They have a need for engineering courses because of their big customer of Los Alamos National Lab. Our Valencia campus probably will not participate in the same way. They are very close. Students go back and forth. They can have access. So basically, that's the model. We have an operating agreement with all of our branches. We're incorporating this language into the operating agreement. I've been working with the provost, former provost Adala. I've been working with Provost Wood. We've been working with the president. So I met with Pamela. I met with the operations committee, and I was invited to come and at least share what we're hoping to accomplish in terms of meeting those needs out in our community. And I want to say one last thing. We're not interested in analyzing our online program. Most of you probably that know me know that I invested many, many years in building that. And I think it's the future. But that said, a lot of students are not able to successfully complete the online program. Number two, they're not able to relocate or travel to Albuquerque to finish the program, which is a hardship for them. So we're hoping that we're offering yet another option as we move forward. And that's my role and my job, so I'll stop here.
So Jerry, I want to ask one question that I heard from some people. Mm-hmm. Is this a course release? And maybe Provost Wood, you could answer this. Course release or overload? Let's say it was a business class and you asked X, Professor X, to drive to Gallup. would Professor X get paid overtime, or would he get a load reduction here?
So the first thing to say is no one will be required.
No, of course.
No faculty member
right.
Course.
Absolutely.
It is imaginable if it's part of a regular course load,
okay.
Or for extra pay that's high enough that the faculty member finds it worth their while.
Right, to do that.
Any of those models.
Okay, thanks for that. And then I really, we have all five of our campuses, branch campuses here, senators today. So we've got Gallup, we've got Taos, we've got Valencia, which we're not talking about today, and we've got Los Alamos with Dennis. So could we ask them, Gallup, let's start with Gallup. What do you think? What have you heard? What do you know? Or Tracy, either one.
What I would like to bring forward is exactly what Aaron said about a lot of our students are really locked into their location. They're taking care of children, they're taking care of elders. They don't have a lot of transportation except for what passes as reliable navigable transit buses. It would be difficult for them to get around. And the internet is difficult for them to access. We need to do that. In those school districts that we're talking about very often, the teachers come from Teachville America. They're not even certified trainers. Mm-hmm. And the branch of Western New Mexico that was there that offered a teaching certificate has closed. So if anything, this is an opportunity for UNM to fill this niche and this great need. Because if you have Navajo students, they don't want to leave their area. Who better to work with the Navajo children? We're keeping them there to do their student teaching within their own communities. Okay. So I hope that you can see this as an opportunity.
Great. Thanks, Tracy. John?
One thing, there are branch faculty out there that might be willing to teach it.
And qualified.
Qualified to teach it.
Right.
So don't think that. And because of that, sometimes we are always looking to get out of the teaching that's always teaching roughly the same courses semester over semester. We get an additional one here or there. This might be the opportunity for us scholastically and to that to get a chance to teach us, I'll call it special class or continuing class, maybe not once
upper level
class, more frequently than we are allowed to do now.
So it's positive for you, though.
Yeah, it's
sounds very positive. Okay. Amy, Taos, any thoughts?
I think it's actually very very similar to the Gallup situation. Our students are very similar in the sense that they don't have access necessarily to come to the main campus, whether it be financial or whether it be just you're stuck at home caring for their children or their families. It's just the way it is in those types of communities. So they're very locked into their community, and then to get out, it's really big.
And in the winter, it's just hard to get out of the house.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the winter, that's a whole other story. Right, that it's very difficult. So I think this would be very positive. Mm-hmm. And I think to speak to your scholastic point, one of the things that we see when we have lower level courses only, meaning that we can only teach 100 or 200, it doesn't give our students a great opportunity in certain areas to expand beyond that. So my example is, you know, we have approximately four courses that we can teach in the Spanish department at the lower level. Mm-hmm. And then what do our students do? Mm-hmm.
If they started in three, they're pretty much almost done.
Right. So they're kind of, so that doesn't give our students a great opportunity either. So yes, this would be a positive.
Okay, great. Dennis, Los Alamos. I have a hard time. That seems not so far to me, but maybe it's the same.
Well, it's pretty much the same as Taos. I mean, the perception is that Los Alamos is a very affluent community. Okay. There is a percentage that's very under par in terms of economic ability. And, you know, we do serve them. A lot of them can't leave. There are a lot of people who work at the labs with associate degrees who are trying to, you know, get bachelor's and master's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their jobs are good. Their money is good, but they want to move up. So, you know, that would definitely be.
Okay, so helpful there too. Cheryl, I'm going to skip Valencia since you're not involved in this. Is there a reason we should not be skipping Valencia?
Well, I just have a question regarding this because even though, like with, say, the AA degree that we can get, and they're changing that on the state level and teaching all of that, I understand. But I recently heard that maybe main campus is not happy if we teach courses past that, even though they're 1 and 2 level courses. So, for instance, I would like to offer those psychology classes that meet all the prereqs if somebody wants to major in psychology. I just want to make sure that that's something that's acceptable and that we wouldn't get pushed pushback on something like that?
Turn to the provost on that one.
So like everywhere else, the instructors would be vetted by the main campus department, because by state law, that's required, right? So both the course and the instructor would be vetted. But in the same way they vet, if they hire an adjunct professor at main campus to teach, if you meet those qualifications, you get passed and you're allowed to.
And this is one internal courses. I'm not even talking about
it. And part of what's going on, I understand, I may have been guilty of this as a chair. Departments tend to just sort of fail to respond, not approve, right? Just delays because it's not a priority. Part of what this structure does is put some pressure on departments. If they don't act,
right,
the branch gets okay to find somebody else to offer this. The idea here is to create incentives for everybody to make good decisions that really drive that.
I like that better, because someone called it extortion when they talked to me, so that sounds better.
Just a couple more comments, Pamela. Be mindful, the upper division and the graduate courses belong to the main campus. Mm-hmm. They have mm-hmm. the right to qualified faculty, to the curriculum, the same standards, nothing's going to change. Branches cannot offer anything above 200 level courses. So it's ours. You know, we have
right.
control of that. And I hope that there are faculty that want to have that experience. If you have not been to one of our branches, they're great.
Yeah, I got to see Taos this summer with the president, and it was my first time, and it was really wonderful.
They serve a community. And it's economic development for those communities.
And also, Jerry, you and I discussed it wouldn't be taking, we in the music department say butts out of seats, right? Maybe that's not a very nice way of saying it. But those people would not be coming if we didn't offer this. So we're expanding our student body, not retracting anything. I don't want to let all the other senators have nothing to say. I started with the branch just for the obvious reason. How do main campus and north campus faculty feel about it, Lee?
So I think it's a great idea. I have just two informational questions. One is, under the state funding formula, would these individuals count and get us more money?
Yes, they will pay main campus tuition and fees, and they will count for entry.
And the second is, if you get main campus faculty to go up there for a semester, say, and teach a course, would you have some place for them to live during the week?
Let me respond to it this way. When I was the vice provost for our extended university, I was working with our graduate school. We were working for Gallup to try to find housing, affordable housing, so that they chose to do that. We were trying to attract certain students that... I mean, a lot of our not every doctoral student that completes your wants to go to a research university. They may want to go to a comprehensive, and some of them may want to go to a community college. So the answer is yes, we would have to work to find ways to make that, if that was the case, if a faculty member. In the past, in Gallup, we had at one time, I think, four faculty that lived there. I mean, they taught for the college education, and they were part of the community. So, yes, we have to look at all options to make it work.
So you're best part of the plan going forward.
If that comes up, you can bet we will work in that way.
That's a great idea. Okay. If there are no other, you can always, of course, reach me offline. Yes, my delay notes.
I think there's an important perspective that needs to be presented, even if just for the record, in community engagement discussions, even in the Gallup. There's a big issue about do we own. Are we invested, and how can we get invested in some of these branch campuses? Because they feel alien to us. That came up in Gallup. They took away the child development center that we could send our students to watch the children to their students who go to school. Mm-hmm. They took this away. And so there's also some issues of mistrust with UNM. So in addition, if you're going to build a curriculum program and looking at that from the inside, you also have to look from the outside in. How can we get these communities out there to feel that these branch campuses belong to them, as opposed to they've just been exported in? And I think we have to work really, really hard on that, because, and there's also concerns about the hybridization, that's important. In other words, combining online with actual still doing what I call face-to-face teaching, because you're right, a lot of the resources do not exist out there. And so I would say the relationship and trust issue and getting communities to feel vested that branch campuses belong to them is a critical issue as well, in addition to, you can develop the curriculum,
But if you don't have the community feel invested in it, it's not
right.
As far as we want.
Does that resonate?
Right. And some of these will be blended. There will be opportunities for Zoom technology to be part of the delivery so that we don't put that huge hardship on faculty having to try to come to, go to Taos in the winter and come back. Hmm. Or even Los Alamos up the hill. Or even try going from that branch to Dallas.
I'm sorry, my time management is very bad today. I'm 20 minutes off. Thank you, Jerry, so much. The discussion will keep going, so thank you.
Thank you.
Most would appreciate that. Okay, Paul Edmonds, you waited so patiently. Come on up. This is our Associate Director of the GEO, Global Education Office, Paul Edmonds, who's also the Director of the CELAC program, which is an acronym, something English as a second language. You'll figure it out. I don't know how to decipher that.
Thank you so much. Thank you, President Pyle. Members of the Faculty Senate, members of the audience, thank you so much. It's going to be really hard following on Dr. Dominguez, but I'll do my best. We also have Mr. Pablo Potas, Director for International Admissions here, for our support, Dr. Nicole Tommy, Global Education Director, and Ms. Vanessa Vandergalian, who's our CELAC Academic Manager. So essentially, we've been working really hard for a couple of years now. We really want to thank Dr. Charlie Steen. Thank you, Rick.
Yay.
Dr. Charlie Steen for his support and guidance through this process and to President Pyle as well. Let's see. Can you point it this way? How do I do this, Rick?
The left-right arrow should be left-right.
Does he point it at the computer?
Point it at the computer?
Okay, I'll do it for you.
I didn't know.
You may not be on.
So I'll just make this really quick. We are the Center for English Language and American Culture in the Global Education Office. We're actually celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. We're one of the few intensive English programs that survived 9/11 and continues to do quite well, even with some pressures on enrollment for different social and geopolitical reasons. We offer 5 levels of instruction to our students. The basic goal of our program is to prepare our students with the English that they need to succeed in their academic courses at UNM, and actually the majority of our students, more than 50% of our students, matriculate into UNM for full-time degree studies at either the undergraduate or the graduate level upon completing our program. Some of them go to another English-speaking university to do the same, or they might go back home to their countries to work and so on. And so what we've been doing is we've been following the UNM schedule, 16 weeks, semester and 8-week summer programs to prepare the students just for this. Currently, to essentially graduate through our program, it requires both doing well in our classes and passing the TOEFL test. And these are the current international admissions requirements for UNM for the international students. These requirements will stay the same. These are still options for admissions for students who would like to apply directly into degree programs at UNM. But what we are offering now is another pathway for students to get into the university. And so in collaboration with Dr. Charlie Steen and the admissions and registration arm of the Faculty Senate with President Pyle, we also presented this with Dr. Coonrod's Graduate and Professional Student Organization of the Faculty Senate, as well as the Curriculum Committee for comment with Dr. Wittstrom. And what we've come up with is a pathway for our students who complete the highest level of our instruction, which is level 5, the academic bridge level, to be acceptable for full-time academic study at the undergraduate level or the graduate level, pending the graduate department's approval of this, right? If the graduate department were to say, as they do with the TOEFL, instead of a 550 on the TOEFL, you actually need a 600, that's up to the graduate department, and that would still be the case. But if a graduate department would like to accept our students as is, we are very happy to send them to you.
So this is without, I don't know, did you get that? Without the TOEFL, then, this is the pathway if you've passed this. So it would be the equivalent unless a program says no. In my department, this is very helpful. As you can imagine, in music, it's a different level we're looking for. So I suppose every department would have the right to say, no, sorry, you need to take the TOEFL, right? At the graduate, but not undergraduate, right? Okay.
The undergraduate level is controlled with international admissions and Pablo Flores.
Got it.
And I'd like actually Pablo to present the next slide, but just a few things that I'd like to mention about our students. The benefit of receiving our students into the classes as is these are students who have been on our campus for at least 16 weeks, many of them up to a year. So they're very familiar with the campus. They've been to the Advising Center. They know the resources. They know about UNM Learn. They've been to the CAPS or the, what is it called now, the CTL. They know about the Language Learning Laboratory and so on. So they're very much integrated into our services. We did a study of our students, and we noticed that over the past 3 or 4 years, the students who have finished our program and gone on to degree-seeking studies, they've been getting a 3.5 or above GPA in the classes. They're very, very well qualified, and they're taking really hard classes in any department, right? So they are really competing with our domestic students, or I could say native English-speaking students. And they are looking to go on to these degree programs. So what we're trying to do is give an improvement to an existing program, and then a new pathway into degree-seeking status. Maybe Pablo, if you don't mind mentioning a little bit about some of the benefits of this of the program from the international admission standpoint and so on.
Sure. So for international admissions, we're always looking for ways to attract more students to UNM, and across the U.S., applications have fallen. Thankfully, at UNM, our enrollment has remained relatively steady, but we still need to improve our application just because those have dropped ahead for international students. But thankfully, enrollment has held pretty steady. And in terms of finding pathways, this is not a new idea that we're coming up with. This is a set of universities. Other universities have English language programs, and they offer a pathway entry into the programs through their English school. So you know about 50% of the students who graduate from the CI program enroll at UNM Academic Study. And so I think that with this, we would probably see a little bit larger number because those students, they're already living here. They settled in Albuquerque. It's harder for them to uproot and then move to another institution. But other universities that are offering this type of program that I've seen are University of Utah, University of Kansas, University of Illinois, Chicago, Florida International University. And so it's not a strange or really experimental type of thing. It would just make it easier for students to pass and to come in and just be another way of doing that. Instead of having them go outside, take a TOEFL or IELTS exam, this would be a way that just makes it streamlined for them to come. They're already on campus, they're already familiar with the community, and so if they pass the highest level, I certainly think it would be a good option for these students. And it would be attractive because they're already here, so they don't have to go to somewhere else. Mm-hmm.
Questions for our people? Because this is an action item, I'd like to ask for a motion to endorse this particular pathway from CLAC directly into a program as approved. Yes, Lee?
So I think it's a great idea. I support it. I'm just curious. I assume that whoever teaches somebody English needs to know the student's own language. Now, if it's an unusual and uncommon language, how do you do that?
So actually, that's a great question. Actually, we don't. Because, believe it or not, we have small classes. 16 is typically the maximum. So last semester alone, we had a class of 14 students, all from different countries. And there were only two languages in common out of those 14 countries, a couple of Spanish speakers, a couple of Arabic speakers. Otherwise, they were all speaking different languages. Mm-hmm. There's no way that the instructor could speak all 14 languages, or at least 12 languages. But the really brilliant point of that is there's no other common language. Like the students really and the instructors must work together mm-hmm. to communicate in English and move forward with their learning objectives. So,
hard to understand how that happens, but okay.
Yeah, we have great diversity from cultural and language backgrounds in our center, which has been a real, real plus for our students and for us, ourselves as well.
So I'd like to ask for a motion to endorse this pathway from the Senate. Anyone feel like moving? Thank you, Tara. Got a first? Got a second? Rebecca, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Yes. Any abstentions? Any disapprovals? We good? Thank you so much. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
You've done
such
a great job. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Pablo.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Yeah, we're good. We have one more important item. Yes, ma'am.
Just a follow-up question. Where does this go from here? We endorsed
it. Where does it go?
So with the admissions and registration committee, it's working with the registrar to simply add this as a pathway to admission in the UNM catalog. Thank you so much.
So I didn't want to say the worst or the best for last, but we have a very... depends on what you're going to tell us. But there are some potential ERB changes that Dorothy Anderson and Joey Evans from the Human Resources Department are going to speak to us about. And I've also brought Kathy Guimond, who was the president of a retiree association and our former police chief, because she's intimately involved in this. And Kathy, actually, I have your thing to put up there if we want. But let's listen to you two first.
Okay.
Then we'll sick Kathy on you, just in case. I always have to bring an expert when I talk to you guys, because it's another language.
So I'm Joey Evans. I'm the director of university benefits. And hopefully everybody has this document, because it got sent out with the agenda. What's important to understand about the proposed changes that the ERB is looking at making to bring the pension plan to a 100% funded status is that at this point in time, these are only items that they are recommending. This has not gone in front of the legislature or anything like that at this point in time. So almost all of these items are legislative changes, so they would have to go through that process. What we're doing, we've been meeting with a stakeholder group to provide input around what type of changes that we feel the university could live with and not live with. It's easier.
Yeah, no, it is.
So the other piece, too, is there was a ERB survey that went out this past spring. Any member of the ERB was eligible to participate in, and they have posted the results of that surveys on the ERB site. So, of course, it's very important that you continue to review the ERB site, nmerb.org, for documents, information, public meetings, et cetera. But the results of that survey are on the site, and really most of these items are a reflection of that survey. So I will just briefly hit on the items as we go through that the ERB is recommending. It's important to understand also that this is a package deal. The ERB isn't looking at necessarily itemizing these and saying, okay, we'll do this one and this one. They're looking at presenting this as a package deal that all of these items will achieve, combined, will achieve the funding status within the amount of time that the ERB wishes to have the plan at 100% fully funded. So the first item is the ERB is looking at increasing the employer contributions to the fund by 3%. They're looking at phasing that in 1% each year for 3 years.
Right, so, Pamela just said, oh, that's great. Well, it's great.
No, I said it's crazy.
Oh, okay.
No, I said it was great. I was like, no, I said it's crazy. Where is UNM going to get the money, is what I said.
Right.
Yeah, no, I did not say great. By the way, just to pause, how many of you are ERB members and not CIAHF? I paid into your fund, which is another thing I'd like us to discuss someday. Yeah, you like that. Okay, go ahead, Joey.
Right, yes. So from a standpoint of looking at positions that are instruction and general funded or ING funded, then that's the funding that comes to the state that we would anticipate that the state would fund if they increased the employer contribution. But that's only about 50% of our positions when you include HSC as well as main campus and branch campuses. So the other 50%, those positions would have to come from funding, whether it be grant funded, auxiliary enterprises, et cetera. So the university would have to come up with that money. The next piece, and we put just basic dollar amounts, so we're looking at 1% increase. It costs the university about $350,000 a year for non-ING funded positions. So at the end of the 3 years, that 3% increase is over $1 million of recurring funds per year. The next piece is they're looking at requiring para-retirees to contribute to the pension plan. So currently, if you retire from para and you come to work for the university or for any education employer. The employer has to contribute to the fund, but the retiree, the pararetiree, does not contribute to the fund. So they're looking at requiring pararetirees to contribute. It does not have a financial impact to the university, but obviously has a financial impact to pararetirees who are going to be working for the university. And of course, one of our biggest concerns that we've vocalized is the safety positions, particularly since, since most of our police department are pararetirees. So that's the major current concern that we have vocalized around that. The other piece, so
so just as a point of clarification on that one, so the pararetirees would be required to contribute about 11% of their salary. So that would be a decrease, so
right.
Which is the same as other employees. But again, if we're already competing with APD for officers, we would worry about losing them. So there might be a proposal to increase their base salaries by the difference in order to retain them. So that's
open. That comes from the state, though, right? Where would that money come
from?
Just from your end. So is what's running this fully funding the ERB? That weird thing they have to have it completely funded in case we all retire today? Is there any, can anyone question the sanity of that, right? Because that probably means the world has ended.
Well, the biggest thing, or what they said that actually made sense to me, was that they're paying out more than what they're bringing in. And so what they're trying to do is bring in an amount that's much more equal, so to get to that 100% solvency. So even though there's enough money in the fund to pay all of us if we were to retire, the concern would be for future hires.
Items, three and four are somewhat related. The bottom line is the return to work program, in which you can sit out a year and then return to work and you earn your pension as well, also earning pay. That sunsets at the end of 2021. So in the combination of trying to identify what to do with the return to work program, and that's a legislative piece, return to work program. They're also combining that with how to treat the return to work exception, or essentially make the return to work exception go away. So the return to work exception is basically an administrative decision that the board made to allow individuals who do not sit out a year to come back in restricted status with no layoff, meaning that they come back whether they are restricted to earning $15,000, the greater of $15,000 a year, or 25%. So what they're looking at doing is moving forward, they're proposing to, they would grandfather in the current individuals who are either return to work or in the working exception. But they're proposing to, in the future, make everybody sit out for 6 months. And then once you sit out for 6 months, you would be able to return with no exception, no
restriction. Yeah.
No limit on earnings, right, or appointment percent salary. Obviously the concerns are situations in which individuals, that transfer of university knowledge, individuals that leave and are able to come back under the return to work exception, they're not contributing, and they're able to help transfer of knowledge. What they would be looking at is everybody that comes back, if they meet the criteria to contribute as a member, then they're going to have to contribute. So everybody would sit out 6 months, and if you return, you're going to be paying into the fund and not have a recalculated benefit. Obviously, the only way you can get a recalculated benefit is you suspend your retirement. So those two items were closely related. The item number five, they're proposing, this is a proposal, this design impacts current members. But for any new members, July 1, 2019 and forward, they're looking at providing for a tiered pension multiplier. So what they're looking at doing is, for the first 10 years of work, your pension multiplier would be 1.35%. The next 10 years would be 2.35%. And then the third 10 years, once you hit 30 years, you would be at that 3.35%, with the expectation that if you work 30 years, your maximum multiplier would be 2.35%, which is what it currently is. But they're looking at tiering it to really get people to work longer. The longer the money's in the fund, obviously, the better it does. And also, this, you know, this would impact individuals who are retiring under the 5 years and age 67 criteria, or the rule of 85, or even the rule of 75 as well. So they're looking at moving forward to have that tier multiplier. They're looking at a little bit of a higher multiplier for greater than 30 years, but it still would have to be actuarial equivalent to the tiered structure that they're looking at. And then finally, they're looking at a suspension on the COLA. So currently it's a reduced COLA, and either you have a 10% reduction on your COLA or a 20% reduction on your COLA currently, depending on what your years of service and what your if you're below the median pension benefit. What they're looking at doing is either is suspending it. The initial proposal was to suspend it for 5 years or 10 years or until fully funded. Doesn't appear that there's a significant difference between suspending the COLA for 5 years or 10 years. But as of this last stakeholder meeting, there was discussion around capping the COLA at 1% until the fund is fully funded.
Versus
the 5 year, versus the full suspension.
And they're currently getting about 2%?
Yeah, it's like 1.7. I think this year is 1.6 or 1.7. Whereas the full, once if they suspend it for once the fund is funded, sorry, couldn't figure out a different way to say that. Once it's fully funded, it would revert back to the pre-2013 COLA, which is I think it's half of CPI, no less than 2%, no greater than 4%, and there's no reduction. So. Next steps, we have a stakeholder meeting on September 6th, providing additional feedback, and the Jan Goodwin wants to present this to the board in October as a package deal of four recommendations.
Jan Goodwin is the one who voted to give herself $40,000 raise and her people, and that shut down. So, right, I actually hear this as a very dangerous thing, which is why I asked Kathy to join us. So again, former police chief and head of our retiree association. I'm not pitting them her against these guys. They're all working together for us. I just knew she had a different perspective. So I'm giving my seat to Kathy to speak. You don't literally need to sit in my seat, but I'm giving you my side. Okay.
Well, I think the perspective that I bring is as a retiree, and having worked with the retiree association 4 years. What I promised Pamela years ago is that when it was time to ring the bell, ring the alarm bell, that I would let her know. So I'm ringing the alarm bell.
She called
bell.
Me twice this summer.
all of this, obviously what the retiree association and retirees throughout the state, whether they're pre-K to 12, or higher education, what we're all concerned about is what happens when there is no COLA, or if there is no COLA. And so what we've been doing is communicating with all of our group and the staff council, and Pamela and I have been talking back and forth. And what happens, I mean, the reason that we have a COLA, a cost of living adjustment, is so that we can keep up with inflation, and so that you don't lose purchasing power after you retire. And that's the whole purpose of a COLA. And to be effective, it needs to be compounded. So the COLA varies in the ERV. It typically does not vary in PERA, the ERA, but it does vary in the ERV. 1 year, we got 0.08%. So that was the year it was like, don't spend it all in one place.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't mean to make light of that, but what happens if we don't have a COLA? Let me give you an example. If we don't have a COLA for, let's take a 10-year period. If there's no COLA, then you have no hedge against inflation, and your purchasing power is going to go down. Now, the first year, if it's a 2%, let's just say, for the sake of argument, it's a full ERB COLA, which would be 2%, roughly. So, you know, the first year, you're going to be able to get through, and probably the second and the third year. But no matter who you are, if you're losing 2% a year times 12 years, okay, I'm not a math wizard, but that means that you're losing, over that 10-year period, 20% of your retirement. And what I'm not good at is compounding that. So you have to compound that. So what we want to do in the Retiree Association, what we are trying to do, is get legislators to understand that it's about people individually who are retired. And, you know, most of us, even if we had to, would have trouble going back to work. Most people retire when they kind of sort of hit the wall. And they've planned it for a long time. So what we don't want to do is we don't want to place people who are on a state pension. We don't want to burden the state with what might happen. It's not just UNM. It's higher education, it's community colleges, and it's teachers. The biggest part of the ERB are K-12 or now pre-12 teachers. And most of them don't make a whole lot of money. And, you know, what the ERB is fond of saying is, well, yeah, but they have Social Security. Well, if you don't make a significant amount of money, you also get hit without a huge Social Security blanket. So what we don't want to do is we don't want people to be burdens on the state at any level of education. It's what we do.
So, Kathy, I just want to stop because we just have 5 minutes left. So, Dorothy, Joey, Kathy, what people here who are in the ERB, what do you suggest they think about, do? Are there actions to take?
So again, it's kind of a mixed emotion for me because I'm very interested in getting the funds 100% budget. I think we're in a unique situation where the state has money that they're willing to start paying that employer contribution. For them to say, we're going to give us, is it 63%? Do you remember what that dollar amount was? It was like $62 million it would cost the state to fund that. And so again, for them to say, they'll pay that employer portion, we need to take advantage of that, but we need to take advantage of it in a way that's meaningful. So again, maybe it's not the full 3%, because you know most stakeholders, like K-12, CNM, they're all fully funded. So they're looking at that and they're saying, this is great. You know, the state is going to put money in for our pension. So we, UNM, we're in a unique situation where we're going to have to make up that difference for our auxiliaries and for our grants and for our HSC. So we have to be thoughtful in what our position is. So I think that's very important that we realize it is a unique opportunity and we really need to figure out what it is we can tolerate. So I'm meeting with ABLE Level hopefully next week so we can put some of these numbers in front of her, because the biggest hit is really the HSC. We UNM can look at the rest of it internally and figure out how we can make that work. But I don't think we should say automatically we don't want to do this, because we do want to do this.
Okay.
And again, even the para piece, return to work, retirees, those that sit out a year, you come back in your ERB, you're contributing. So you contribute as an ERB working retiree, you don't gain extra service. Para retirees, they're an exception. Mm-hmm. So again, we want to protect our officers, so we need to figure out how do we protect our officers and the other para retirees. Absolutely okay for them to contribute.
Well, 11% sounds like a lot. So, John and then Lee.
Sorry, I'm not very knowledgeable, but I have a couple of concerns. One is the word fully funded.
Yeah.
Let me just make that clear.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Fully funded means you have some mythical growth rate on funding.
Yes.
Mythical. So, if you overachieve, you would be fully funded with less money. If you overachieve, and or if you got underachieve, you need more money. It's mythical. Okay? Second, where in all of this is performance of the people that are investing the funds? To have anything without recourse to either competence or incompetence of the managers is impossible. So I don't even see that here. So there's mythical stuff, and then there's no recourse to get good managers. Two big problems.
Okay, Kathy wants to answer that?
Yeah, let me, it's the difference between solvency. And Jan Goodwin, at the last IPOC meeting, at the IPOC meeting in July, IPOC is a legislative committee that oversees state pensions. So at that committee meeting, one of the legislators asked her, so when do we run out of money? And the answer, her answer, and I'm quoting, was never. So it's not about the solvency of the fund. Today, it's about 63% solvent. PARA is about 66%. That puts them in the middle nationally. But sustainability is about an accounting standard. And I think you're exactly right. It gets to be a crystal ball, but it's something that we all have to live with.
Anyway, you're also right. Cost of living is real.
Yes. Yep.
And it's just a game that's being played. So I'm sorry, there are three games on the table.
It is.
And they're all fraudulent, and we need real concern about all.
Okay, good. That's what Kathy's thinking, too. Lee, what was your question? HSC, do you really think?
Well, in a minor way. So I wonder if the tiered multiplier clause 5A has been looked at by somebody knowledgeable in discrimination law, because it's clearly a violation of a protected class. That is, anyone 50 years of age or older who would think of joining UNM is not going to be here for 30 years in order to benefit from the full 2.35% multiplier that only occurs if you're here for 30 years. If you're here 10 or 20 years, it's going to be much less, and that's discriminatory against a protected class. Mm-hmm. And somebody better look at that who knows something about discrimination law. I came here when I was 53. If this had been in effect, I wouldn't be here right now.
Right.
No way.
Right. So we're going to lose good people. How do we address those sorts of issues? It is the end of our session. I don't want to keep people longer, but what should we do? How should we think about this? I see there's a meeting. I have a feeling none of us is so up on it, although maybe John, Lee, you and Lee should go. How do we help?
So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get our government relations department to really go out there and figure out which piece of this really has momentum, so which one should we be addressing. Because, you know, Joey said it's a package. You know, this isn't exactly what they're formulating. I think what they're looking at is what can we get away with.
Right.
And
well, it'd be great for us to push back as a unified front, though, with all the educators across the state. I don't know if that's a United Faculty Senate effort. If it's what you tell us.
Well, again, you've got to figure out who's going to get behind you, because, again, some of these issues only affect 1M.
Well, this body stood up for the pre-65s, and we increased our own contributions by a small percentage because they were going to be kicked out of the pool. So I think there is some goodwill to help everyone. You know.
We'd like to invite you guys to join us.
Okay, at the Retiree Association,
yes.
So maybe that is a project the Senate should take up, and maybe we need to think about that a little bit. Patty, you and I will keep talking. This is nothing is set in stone until the session, right?
Right. So what they're going to do is they're going to present, though, one of our dates with the 19th to the board for proposing.
Board of Regents?
No.
I'm sorry. ERB board. Oh, I'm sorry. When you say board.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the 6th, yeah.
Yeah, so what they're going to do is we're going to come back on the 6th of September to figure out where we are. Our position hasn't changed. We put up strong resistance to these items indicating the impact it has to UNM.
Okay. The COLA thing seems that we would not negotiate on that. That seems incredible to me that they would like to lower it or keep it the same, despite the fact that inflation is functioning in the real world. Right. But thank you all. I know you're the bearer of interesting news. Okay, so we have really no time, but does anyone have any new business they'd like to broach at this point? Then I'd like a motion to adjourn. And is that
Carla,
thank you so much. Don't let the door slam you on the way. Thanks, everyone.
Speak too soon.
I need to retire so I can get cost of living raises.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the raises I